let's talk about is recorded and produced in Treaty 1 territories, on the original lands of the Anishinaabe, Cree, Oji-Cree, Dakota, and Dene peoples, and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. Thank you very much for listening. So, if you were living under a rock or you were not paying attention to the news in the last week, you will know that the United States had their midterm elections. It is just key elections that happen in the middle of a presidential term, which is 4 years. So, after 2 years, it's midterms, yada, yada, yada. I saw some people wondering why it's called that, and I was asked why it was called that. So, quick little explanation. But heading into these midterms, the general trend throughout pretty much all of American history is that with the two parties in power, they tend to swing like a pendulum back and forth. There will be two terms of a Republican president, then two terms of a Democratic president. Then on back and forth, the actions of one influencing the actions of another, back and forth as those two parties vie for, I guess, the heart and soul of America. But within that larger pendulum swing, they tend to have these shifts in the midterm elections. Usually the party that's in controlling the Senate or the House will lose control of that. And this year was no exception. There was a lot of currently, for the first 2 years of his presidency, American President Joe Biden has enjoyed his party's control, majority control of the House and the Senate. They still required, we're still under the auspices of the filibuster in the Senate, but they had control of the House, control of the Senate, which means they control the lower and upper chambers of the legislature, and were able to put through a lot of bills and put through a lot of policy that they otherwise would not have. One of the complicated, but I think personally, great things about having two houses, having one that is generally controlled by the opposite party, the opposition, the opposition party in the U.S., but the opposition as like a catch-all term, in Canada, is that it kind of necessitates bipartisanship, or compromise and working together. The reason that we have elected officials is to represent us, and I think it does a disservice to a lot of people to not be represented properly, and to not have their voice heard and their party's perspective and voice heard. Even though, like, it really in Canada, the two parties largely agree on most things. It's the same thing as, like, you might be, on a large amount of issues, you might agree with somebody, but you don't agree on the methods for achieving that goal. You want to make things better for Canadians. Well, what's the process to get there? You want to lower unemployment. You want to lower inflation. You want to reduce crime. You want to increase national GDP. Okay, how do we actually go about doing that? The actual methods are really where the parties differ. We all have this shared goal, which is making lives better, but the details is where the differences happen. But having the two sides, having control of the two chambers means that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to make sure that everyone agrees on policies moving forward. That can create a lot of log jams. It can create a lot of inefficiency. We've seen it here in Canada. There's a lot of issues with, you know, necessary bills and necessary legislation, and really legislation that is agreed upon by a majority of Canadians, not going through because the two parties, the two major parties of the Liberals and Conservatives, bicker over the details. Few things, you know, things can get done a little bit more efficiently if the Liberals are in power, because the NDP tends to side in a way with the Liberals, but they will want concessions if the Liberals want to earn their votes. And that's where you kind of get that representation from. But the general trend is that the party that controls one of those chambers loses it in the midterm election. The party that's in power or holds the presidency in the United States tends to lose one of, or both of those chambers, because over those 2 years, the other party gets a chance to point at everything the other side has done wrong for 2 years and try and drag Americans to their side, drag all those swing voters to their side. And we were expecting, or a lot of analysts were expecting, pretty much the same this year. They were expecting that that this red wave or this red tsunami was going to happen in the United States, and there was going to be this overwhelming majority of Republican representation in the House and the Senate. And when it came down to it, nothing changed. In fact, it was a historic result for the Democratic Party, where they held on to control of the House, and the Georgia seat, one final Georgia seat in the Senate hasn't been decided, so it's still up in the air. But if the Republicans win, it'll be a 50-50 split, and the president is the tiebreaker. So, or the vice president is the tiebreaker, and she is Kamala Harris, the vice president of the United States, who is a Democrat. So that means the Democrats hold power in the Senate as well. So for the next 2 years, the rest of Joe Biden's potentially first or only term in office, the Democrats will hold both chambers, which is huge. And that is unprecedented in the fact of it was not in any way expected. Lots of analysts were looking at it and saying, okay, this is going to happen. This red tsunami, this red wave is going to happen. It always happened. Like the houses always flip during the midterms. There's this big push. There's a lot of animosity towards the Biden administration right now. And what happened was the exact opposite, and left people kind of baffled, left analysts spinning as to how this could have happened. And it seemed that by and large, it was driven by people getting out to vote that typically did not. We saw a major uptick in voter turnout in the U.S. among the Gen Z population, the Zoomer population, which overwhelmingly vote Democrat. And they were key in swinging a lot of districts and a lot of seats. We've been talking for years and years and years about how young people need to vote, how young people are the future, how if, you know, the millennial and Zoomer populations all vote, they control the destiny just by virtue of the population. Largely, they control the destiny of where the country will go. And it's very much the same here in Canada. But young people never voted. And there's a lot of reasons for people not to vote. There's a lot of reasons that voting has been made difficult. But what I want to talk about today, and what I want to talk specifically about with this episode, is how we got the polls so wrong. how analysts in the US and Canada got the prediction so wrong. And I say we, I had no idea the midterms were happening. That shows you how much I am paying attention to American politics right now. But how did analysts get this so wrong? And it comes down to really a methodological flaw in polling. And I believe I've talked about this in various different episodes. I've mentioned it, but I don't know if I've dedicated a whole episode to it. I've talked about polling and how polling works ahead of a previous election. And, you know, just to set the stage, polling, when you're looking at polling, you have to look at a lot of context because things change very rapidly. Now, I've got 338 Canada open, and 338 Canada's a statistical model that was created by Philippe J. Fournier, who's a physics and astrophysics professor, and he's also a political columnist. He created this algorithm or this projection statistical model, which consolidates projections from a bunch of different websites and a bunch of different media outlets, and puts them together. He looks at provincial polls. He looks at like provincial elections, federal elections, and he always has a running tally because a lot of companies like Ipsos and Legere and Angus Reid do, you know, monthly or quarterly polling for the prime minister and the leaders of parties and voter intentions. So 338 Canada, I will say, if you are ever watching an election and you want to know kind of where the wind is blowing, look at 338 Canada. They tend to get it mostly right. But where does polling go wrong? Well, if you look at it right now, I've got this open on, it was last updated November 13th. I'm looking at it November 14th. The Conservative Party of Canada has a 3% lead over the Liberal Party in their federal vote projection, and the seat projection has them at one seat, 144 to 143, one seat above the Liberal Party, which means that the Conservative Party, in that case, would have a minority government, but would have control. And he actually breaks down the odds of what are the most likely outcomes. There's a 45% chance right now of a Conservative minority, a 43% chance of a Liberal minority, and a 10% chance of a Conservative majority. And that just kind of is the odds of as if an election happened today. But you'll notice there's this plus or minus 4% or plus or minus 3%. So if you're generally looking at polls, the general rule of thumb is that whatever projection you look at, a safe bet to make is that the percentage of, like, if you're looking at voter projections, you look at like vote share projections, you expect those to potentially waver. It's not going to be exactly like this. And this is not exactly how the seats would break down either. But within about 8%, you know, plus or minus 8%, that's what the score is going to be. So right now on 338 Canada, you know, it has the Conservatives at 35% plus or minus 4%. So they can get, you know, based on statistical modeling, can get as high as 39% of the overall vote in Canada, or as low as 31% of the overall vote. The Liberals is 32% plus or minus 4%, so that's up to 36, between 28% and 36%. That's that 8% swing. And then the seat projections, the Conservatives can have up to between 109 and 180 seats, the Liberals 97 to 173 seats. The 170 is the magic number of a majority. So when you're looking at polling data, you need to understand what you're looking at in terms of it's called margin of error. You know, you're saying that there is, based on just on probabilities, it's not going to line up this way. So within, you're going to say you're confident, it's essentially a confidence interval, you are confident within that it's going to be within this range. It's going to be plus or minus 4% of 35% or plus or -4% to 32%. That you're confident that the conservatives will get between 109 and 180 seats in the next election, stuff like that. But the really interesting thing, and I actually did this recently, I overlaid the odds for the election on inflation. So I looked at how the trend line went when inflation was at its highest. So inflation, if you're wondering, here's a little update on inflation. Inflation peaked back in June. If you go on, the Canadian government does a great job of tracking inflation, and it goes back quite a few years, so you can look at the trend line. And you actually break it down to individual price items. So you can look at gas, you can look at food, you can look at medicine, you can look at like automobiles and housing and stuff. But just generally overall, and then you break it down by geography. So you can look like province by province where inflation was for your provinces. But nationally, inflation peaked in June at 8.1%. So it was, the prices were 8.1% higher than this time last year, which is an insane number. But it has begun trending down as the year has begun to close. So it was in July, it was 7.6%. In August, it was 7%. In September, it was 6.9%. So we don't have the October projection yet, or the October numbers yet, because it hasn't been calculated yet. But it's begun trending down. So if you're looking at that peak in June 2022, where did the projections sit? And the projections actually throughout the month of June, when inflation was at its highest, the polls actually favored Justin Trudeau by up to almost 60%. As soon as July hit, basically, there was a precipitous drop in terms of his odds of winning, and it dropped down to almost 30%, while Pierre Poilievre rose and the Conservative Party rose. And actually got crazier. It was almost an 80-20 split midway, like around October. But now it has begun to, the gap has begun to close once again. And they kind of flip-flop. If you look at the trend line, they kind of flip-flop back and forth. Early in 2022, up until Pierre Poilievre was really confirmed as the leader of the Conservative Party, the Liberals were far and away in the lead. So, I mean, that's just one little thing that I was doing, but it was interesting for me to see when inflation was at its worst, where were Canadian, where was the sentiment of Canadians, and it really had not a lot to do with inflation, but more the messaging around inflation. When things got at their hardest in terms of costs rising, that was where a lot of Canadian sentiment was, and the polling sentiment. So really, to get back to what the point of this episode was supposed to be, how do we get polling so wrong? Well, it comes down to, as I mentioned earlier, a methodological flaw in how polling is conducted. A lot of companies, I work with a lot of market research firms in my job, so I know how they work. A lot of them now use online survey platforms, but that only does like the barest job at changing or addressing this methodological flaw. But a lot of polls are drawn off market research. You go out and either a company pays for it. A lot of market research firms do this as like an omnibus study. It just, they have monthly or quarterly tracking surveys that go out and they pull a lot of sentiment data. Like I get you know, quarterly reports from Angus Reid about consumer confidence and you know, beliefs around inflation, because that's topical right now for our business. These companies go out and they have their survey platforms and they have a stable of users who are demographically identified. They've got their age, they've got their, their location, they've got their, where they live, they've got their gender, they've got, you know, all questions around political affiliations and, kind of behavioral activities. But what I want to focus on really is that age piece, because for pretty much as long as we've been doing these surveys, Gen Z, millennials, it's getting easier, but Gen Z in particular is so incredibly hard to find. It costs a lot of money to go out and find and continue to sample for Generation Z. Why? Because for a lot of it, they don't want to do these surveys. They don't want the inconvenience of doing these surveys. Doing them online doesn't bridge that gap. It's still a time commitment. And so what you're doing when you do this is you're missing that voice. When these polls go out, I can tell you based on experience, the easiest groups to get are older, more affluent, and generally retired. People who have a lot of time and are looking for something to do. That's not all of them, because like we get representative samples. Part of what we are supposed to do and part of what survey research does it methodologically is you go out and you find a sample proportion with proportions for gender and race and region and age that follow along with the census distribution of those things for Canada are, or your particular region that you're looking at. So you're going to get a certain percentage of that sample that is from that age group. The issue comes with is that methodologically you are still unable to get those sentiments. You're still unable to get those Generation Z, so you have to make up that response some other way. You either have to adjust, you have to adjust that data to make it representative. And that means that you're going to potentially inflate responses that are already there, and you're going to take those responses and put them across that entire segment. So these polls, they have to be done relatively quickly. Because they are monthly or quarterly, you need to bake in the time to adjust the programming for a survey. You need to adjust, you need to have the weeks of fielding time. It's usually 2 weeks, a week to 2 weeks. Then you have to have the data analysis and report presentation, which all take time. So in that timeline, you are really crunched to try and get those responses. And it leads to people like Gen Z being missed. And really, despite all of the best intentions of market researchers, we're still missing a lot of context. We're still missing, you know, it's not like you can go and ask every single Canadian. We can't even ask every single Canadian to do the census, but you're missing, really, because of the way that these surveys work. You need to have time to do it. You need to have the mental energy to do it. You have to have the interest to do it. The incentive needs to make sense. But we really miss younger people because they don't want to take these surveys, and doesn't matter. The results obviously don't matter to them, and the incentive isn't there for them to actually do it because they are in school or they're working or they're just disinterested with this. You're not getting working class people as well. You know, the incentives might not be enough, or they don't have the time to do it. So you're overrepresenting certain segments of the population with their sentiments. And even the best, you know, statistical models, even the best, you know, hardest working, you know, market research firms do a lot of hard work to make their work representative, you know, using math and statistical principles to make it representative. But really, you're missing things. You're missing key targets. And that's what they were missing in the US, is that they were not accounting for this wave. The wave that happened was a wave of Generation Z getting out, being politically motivated, and going out to make time to vote. That's what they missed, because all of the projections were based on, you know, what was traditionally happening. Back in the day when you were doing these surveys, you would do them over the phone, and you only got to people who had landline phones. You didn't get to people who had, you know, once cell phones became more ubiquitous and people started cutting their landlines, you only had people who were around at certain times of the day. You only had people who were willing to sit there and talk on the phone. You were only getting people who had landline phones and who were easy to reach. Now you are only getting people who have an internet connection and have the time to sit down and do surveys like this, because they take like 10 minutes, 15, they try and keep it below 12 minutes, but still some of them get up there. Some of our surveys have gotten up there. But you're still missing responses. You're still missing sentiment from a lot of people that gets overlooked. And you draw up all these projections and you draw up all of this media narrative around things, and suddenly one domino falls a certain way, and you know, the results are not what you expect. You know, we had during the last two elections media drumming up a lot of concern and discussion around the People's Party of Canada and how that was going to take a bunch of the conservative vote away. A part of what, you know, really drove the growth of the Conservative Party, the Progressive Conservatives in Canada, is the fact that they combined two conservative parties into the Conservative Party of Canada, and that brought all of that vote together. But you're now looking, you're still, when you're doing this polling data, you're still looking at these narratives and you're looking at this data that is not methodologically flawed, but has methodological blind spots that you're not able to really close unless you go out specifically to talk to those people. And even when you talk to those people, you don't know if the people represent that group are actually going to vote. Because historically, it didn't matter if you went out and asked a whole bunch of Gen Z prospective voters if what they were worried about or what they were interested in or who they were going to vote for, because a lot of them didn't vote. They didn't have time to vote. They didn't know how to vote. They didn't, you know, were not interested in voting. They had that voter apathy. I meant to do an episode a couple weeks ago on the voter apathy here in Manitoba or in Winnipeg, because we had 30%. We had 6% of the total Winnipeg population deciding who our prime minister, or not a prime minister. We had 6% of the city's population decide who our mayor is going to be for the next 4 years. And that only accounts for about 10% of the overall voters in Winnipeg. And he got in on about 20, just over a quarter of the vote. So there's this voter apathy that is going on that really is suppressing a lot of voices, because you have very specific people who do go out consistently to vote. So a lot of older people vote. Like, older people vote in crazy numbers, and they, by and large, if young people don't vote, the older people get to decide the policy positions of the country moving forward. That's why we have things, you know, other countries are trying, you know, creating national holidays on election days, so everybody has the day off, so they can, or almost everybody has the day off, so they can go and vote. So this is kind of rambling and rambling on, but it should not surprise people that we got, or that they got, the projections wrong in the U.S. There has been this sleeping giant of young people, the Gen Z, who are becoming more politically aware and radicalized is the wrong term, but politically motivated, and want to go out and vote and want to change things. They totally underestimated how women were going to vote, even in Republican-dominated states, with the problem of Roe v. Wade being repealed and their bodily autonomy being in danger. You saw, because the Biden administration wants to codify abortion rights in, you know, in law, you saw a lot of women getting out to vote so they can try and make that happen. You saw a lot of Gen Z trying to make things like that happen, and it paid off. And we should not be surprised if it happens here in Canada too. All right, that'll do it for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. If you're listening live at 101.5 UM FM, you got some great songs, great shows coming up right after this one. Keep that dial to 101.5, and you can catch me on The Hockey Show this Thursday with Teebs, 5:30 to 6:30. Have a great one, everybody. And as always, have yourselves a wonderful week. Stay safe.